finance laws by using nearly $1 million in funds to allegedly conceal his pregnant mistress's identity during the Democrats' run for the White House 4 years ago. Family, friends, and fans continue to pay tribute to boxing's former heavyweight champ, Smokin' Joe Frazier, who died of liver cancer earlier this month at the age of 67. Today, they gathered near his hometown in South Carolina for memorial services to honor the man whom they describe as the real deal in boxing and an athlete with heart both in the ring and out. Frazier's funeral was held in Philadelphia on Monday. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow is down 70 points. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Cabot Creamery Cooperative, five generations of New England and New York farm families working together to produce naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
On the next Fresh Air, how tax cuts became a focus of Republican policy, what the impact has been, and a look back at why Republican presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush raised taxes. We talk with Tim Dickinson, political correspondent for Rolling Stone. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is our producer. Jason Croft is at the controls. For this hour, we bring you a program from the Focus Archives, a show that we first broadcast in August. It was just before Labor Day, so that means in this hour of the show, we will not be taking calls. In 1914, Joe Hill was convicted of murder in Utah, and the following year, he was executed by a firing squad. The result was an international controversy. People around the world believed that he was innocent and that he had been convicted for one reason only, that he was a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. In this hour of Focus, we'll talk with William Adler about the story of Joe Hill. This is a story that he tells, that William Adler tells, in a book that he's written that's just been published. The title of the book is The Man Who Never Died, The Lifetimes and Legacy of Joe Hill, American Labor Icon. Bloomsbury is the publisher of the book. Bill Adler has written for many publications, including Esquire, Rolling Stone, Mother Jones. He's also the author of The Land of Opportunity, about the rise and fall of a crack cocaine empire, and also Molly's Job, which follows the flight of one woman's factory job from the U.S. to Mexico. He's joining us this morning. And Mr. Adler, hello.
Hi, David. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. I'm really pleased to be able to do this in part, well, because I think we're coming up to Labor Day, so this is a good thing to be talking about, but also because I'm sure that there are many people who know this name. You know, there will be some resonance with Joe Hill, but couldn't really tell you anything about him other than, well, didn't he have something to do with the early history of the labor movement? Or maybe they will know the song that you take your title from. So I think this is one of those chapters of American history that I think people really need to know about.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I was in that same boat probably 6 years ago now. I knew of Joe Hill solely from that song. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. And let me just say, I'm a writer, not a singer, if that's not evident. but that's all I knew. I didn't know if he was a real or even a fictional character. And the reason I wanted to write about him was because I read about him in Bob Dylan's memoir. And Dylan devoted about three or so pages to Joe Hill in that 2004 memoir. And he talked about the same thing, basically. He didn't know who Joe Hill was, only knew him from the folk song. And he started asking around in Greenwich Village. This is when he first came to New York, Dylan. And he learned about him. And what he found was fascinating in terms of Joe Hill really being the cornerstone of the American protest song. And, he drew a direct line from Joe Hill to Woody Guthrie to Pete Seeger to Dylan himself, basically. So that fascinated me in itself, and
yeah.
I got going.
I do that's one of the things that I find really attractive here is that while it's true that he was working man, he was a labor activist, he did organize for the IWW, that maybe also one reason he was thought to be so dangerous was he was a songwriter.
Yeah, isn't that, it sounds almost quaint today. But back then, Joe Hill and the Industrial Workers of the World, the Wobblies, really kind of pioneered the use of song as a weapon in some ways of social protest, and also as a tool for organizing fellow workers, and because it really united them. Song was the one thing that people who were of vastly different backgrounds, different ethnicities, nationalities, even spoke different languages, they could all unite around song, and Joe Hill recognized that, and I think that's really one key to what made him famous and enduring.
Yeah, and I think you write early on that really one of your aims here is to try to determine how it is that he became such an important figure, such a folk hero of American labor. But also, there's something here, and as we go along here in the story, it's going to become very important. You make the argument that Joe Hill didn't have to die. He did have a choice here. He could have defended himself, and he didn't.
That's right, and that is a central argument of the book, and we'll talk about what he was defending himself or not defending himself from in a moment. But, yeah, this was a guy who was a Swedish immigrant and basically just, you know, another anonymous hobo tramping around the country and especially around the American West, and who ultimately found his identity and his voice in the Industrial Workers of the World and became so wrapped up in the IWW that his identity, I think, melded right into the union, and he had a hard time at the end distinguishing between Joe Hill, the individual, and Joe Hill, the icon and the symbol of working class resistance. And in the end, I think that's a major reason why he did decide to die a martyr.
Yeah. Our guest this morning is William Adler. He is the author of the new book, The Man Who Never Died, The Lifetimes and Legacy of Joe Hill, American Labor Icon. Bloomsbury is the publisher. Want to call in, ask question, make comment, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, at the heart of the story here is a story about a crime, a murder, two murders actually, that occurred in Salt Lake City in the winter of 1914. So tell us the story.
Well, on the 2nd January of that year, a grocery store owner named John Morrison and two of his sons, Morrison was 47 years old, were closing up for the night and closing up for the week. Just at closing time, they were sweeping up, and it was kind of a bucolic scene. You know, it was quiet. There was snow falling gently. There was a cat in the window of the store. Two masked and armed men burst into the store, pointed their revolvers at Mr. Morrison, and shouted in unison, "We've got you now," and proceeded to shoot and kill him. That was the first murder. A moment later, one of his sons, a 17-year-old, named Arling, picked up the revolver they kept in the store and took aim at the assailants and may or may not have actually fired. That point was in dispute and remains in dispute all these years later, and it'll become apparent in a minute why it's important whether or not he fired the shot. But in any event, he himself, the son Arling, was shot dead a moment later. And so here we have two murders on that night in Salt Lake City.
So just before closing time, two guys run in, two masked men run in, shoot these two people, and run off.
No attempt at robbery. All they said was, "We've got you now." It seemed at the time to the police and the press to be the motive was revenge. In fact, the Salt Lake Tribune banner headline the next morning was just that, "Holdups kill father and son for revenge." And it didn't seem like there was, you know, any other possible motive since they didn't attempt robbery.
John Morrison had been a police officer, so that maybe made the idea that this was a revenge killing maybe a bit more compelling.
Yeah, he had been a police officer. He was known around town as a gunman, and 4 months earlier, in September of 1913, a similar robbery, or it was a robbery attempt actually that time, occurred. He was on his way home on foot from the store on that Saturday night, and that time he was held up, and that time he fired back, and he may or may not have hit his assailants. There were either two or three of them. He was unsure because he had some night blindness. But in any event, he theorized at the time, this is Morrison, that these guys would come back, they were out to get him, and he wouldn't be surprised if they took another shot at him. Hmm.
So the men run, masked men run in, shoot John Morrison, shoot his son, run off. And the one thing that the police had that they thought might be helpful was that they thought, and as you say, there was some question whether or not, in fact, it happened, but they thought perhaps that Morrison's son had managed to get off a shot and had hit one of the assailants. So that would mean that the one of the guys, at least, that they were looking for would have had a gunshot wound.
Right, but no bullet was found in the store. There was no blood in the store other than from the two victims, the Morrisons, and there really wasn't any conclusive proof the gun had been fired. It was a six-shooter, and there were only five bullets left, but apparently it was custom for Salt Lake Police at the time, and as you said, Morrison was a former police officer, to keep one chamber empty for safety reasons. So a lot of them only carried five bullets anyway, so we don't know. Nevertheless, what happened was about 5 miles away and about 2 hours later after the murders, Joe Hill banged on a doctor's office door, home office door, and the doctor opened it and he found Hill with a bad gunshot wound to his chest. And that is what the state later seized on as conclusive evidence that the younger Morrison shot Hill in the moment before he himself was shot dead. Mm.
And so what made this this complicated, at least for Joe Hill, was so the doctor says, well, how did this happen? Who shot you? And he just said, well, this guy, he shot me. And then when pressed, he said, well, we were arguing over a woman. But that's all he would say, and that's all he would ever say.
That's exactly right. He never named the guy who shot him. He never named the woman. And during his trial, which we'll get to, he refused to testify. So we don't, until now, we had no idea who the friend was and who the woman was.
Yeah. So here is Joe Hill. Ultimately, he ends up being a suspect because he has this gunshot wound. Now, though almost immediately before they get to Joe Hill, the police actually had a suspect, somebody else, and they had him in custody, but then they let him go.
Yeah, they had the man in custody they were initially looking for, the prime suspect, as they called him. He was a guy they knew as Frank Z. Wilson, although as I learned, Wilson was only about one of 16 or 18 aliases that he used. They knew him as Frank Wilson because he had been incarcerated in the state penitentiary for 14 months or so under that alias. It wasn't his real name, but that's how they knew him in Salt Lake City. In any event, he had been seen at the store, not inside the store, but near the store on the day of the murders. And about 90 minutes after the murders, he was seen acting quite strangely. He was splayed on the sidewalk on this snowy, frigid night about a mile from the store. And a passerby encountered him, a guy who was on his way to work on the graveyard shift at the railroad, and thought he might need some help, but it turned out he was just kind of lying there. We don't know why. He was moaning, but I don't know if he was shot or not. Then the fellow gets up, Mr. Wilson gets up from the sidewalk, starts following this passerby like he was going to rob him, but at the end he jumps onto a streetcar and makes his way back to the Morrison's grocery store. So by 1 o'clock in the morning, Mr. Wilson is wandering around the block, literally the block of the grocery store. He's not wearing an overcoat. He's picked up by the police. They talk to him. They say, what are you doing? What are you doing out at this hour, 1 in the morning? He says, I'm just out for a little exercise before bed. And they asked him where he worked. He said he was a busboy at a restaurant and that he was staying at the Salvation Army, neither of which checked out. Also, the next day, they detained him overnight, and the next day they found a bloody handkerchief in his pocket. Nevertheless, 2 days later, they arrested another suspect, Joe Hill, and upon his arrest, they released Mr. Wilson from custody.
So I suppose one could understand that. Here was a man who was behaving suspiciously, had given questionable information to the police, was hanging around the scene of the crime. So, you know, one might understand how they would consider him to be a suspect and would pick him up for questioning. But it seems really unclear here, and I guess really nobody knows, why is it that they ended up letting this guy go?
Well, I think what happened was once they had Joe Hill in custody and once they figured out who he was, initially when they picked him up, and let me just mention that chronology for a moment. Mm-hmm. About 2 days later, they arrested him. It was 2 days later. And that's because the only reason they arrested him was because the doctor who had treated Hill that night, that Saturday night for his gunshot wound, read in the Monday morning papers that the governor had posted a $500 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction. And upon seeing that, the doctor turned in Joe Hill. He thought, well, this guy had a gunshot wound, so he's probably your guy. He went over and shot up Joe Hill with some morphine to knock him out, and then a short time later, the police broke down the door in the boarding house he was staying in and arrested him, took him in, and the papers reported that although this man said his name was Joseph Hill, he actually was Frank Wilson.
Hmm. Well, I suppose that at least you would, in partial defense of the police and their action, if they genuinely thought that one of the assailants had been wounded, here they had a guy who had a gunshot wound, and this other man, the man who said he was Frank Wilson,
right,
whose real name was Magnus Olson, that Magnus Olson, he didn't have a wound. So there, one key feature there, at least the police could say, well, here one guy has been shot, the other guy hasn't. Well, we're going to go with the guy who has the wound.
Well, yeah, but that's true. It's absolutely true. But the other thing they knew right from the outset was that Joe Hill was a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. And the Industrial Workers of the World at that time was seen as a legitimate threat to the power structure, not only in Utah, but across the West. And once they figured out that they had this prized member of the union, they released Mr. Wilson, and they started tailoring the evidence to fit Joe Hill.
Hmm. And is it your judgment based on the investigation that you've done that you think that likely, in fact, this other guy, this Magnus Olson, who had this long police record and was known by many aliases, probably was in fact guilty of the murder of John Morrison?
Yeah, that was my conclusion, and I certainly think that a far stronger circumstantial case could have been made and should have been made against Wilson than was made against Joe Hill at the time. Of course, they didn't know, the police at that point didn't know all that much about Wilson, I don't believe. I spent a year researching Wilson's life and tracing his 50-year criminal background. They didn't have that information, and of course, you know, they only knew up to 1914, but he went on to a career that included a stint as a henchman, as someone in his family put it, for Al Capone, and in fact owned the getaway car used in the 1929 Valentine's Day massacre.
That's just another. This story just keeps getting better and better. That we can say that yes, this man who probably was the guilty party had this long criminal career, and he even played a little part in the St. Valentine's Day massacre. Some ways away from Salt Lake City.
Yeah, no, but I might mention here too that he got his criminal start in Illinois. He was an immigrant as well. Like Joe Hill, he was from Scandinavia, and he stood about the same height, about 6'1". And looked quite alike, but his family had emigrated from Norway to Evanston, and it was there he began his criminal career as a teenager.
Hmm. So there also was some, even though we talked earlier about the fact that the gunmen were masked, apparently there was some passing resemblance between these two men, between Magnus Olsen and Joe Hill.
Yeah. I mean, I think it may have even been more than passing. When you look at the mugshots side by side, you could see why somebody might very well confuse the two. Hmm.
Well, we have a caller here. Let's talk with them. Somebody who is in Champaign County here where we are. This is line number one. Hello.
Well, thank you. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I am interested what Joe Hill was doing in Utah at that time. Was he organizing the lumber industry as the Wobblies tended to do?
Well, there wasn't actually much in the way of lumber there in Utah, but
there were lumbers and miners,
right.
I suppose. Yeah,
right. He had come to Utah in the summer of 1913, so about 4 or 5 months before these murders occurred, and he had worked initially as a silver miner up in Park City, about 35 miles east of Salt Lake City, and then he'd taken ill there, so he'd come back to Salt Lake City. And yeah, he was hanging around the IWW hall, and there was a Swedish community there, so he knew some folks, and he basically was just, you know, recovering from an illness at the beginning of the new year, and wasn't working at the time, but probably would have gone back to work in the mines had he not been arrested.
What was the state of forensic examination of guns and bullets at that time? If the doctor kept the bullet, could it have been matched to the gun?
Yes, it could have been matched. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I'm not sure how you look at it, there was no bullet because the bullet passed through Joe Hill's lung and exited out his shoulder. So no bullet was ever recovered. There was no bullet in the store, no trace of a bullet other than the ones who hit the two murder victims, so we don't know. And, you know, the doctor guessed that it could have been a large caliber, but exactly what caliber it was could not be determined. The only thing they did say, though, was that this was from the injury, it looked like it was a steel bullet that had hit Joe Hill as opposed to a lead bullet, and apparently the gun that they held in the store only shot lead bullets, so that was another reason to cast doubt on whether or not he had been hit in the store.
And sort of a last minute question here: how soon after the trial did the song about Joe Hill show up?
Well, it was first written as a poem, and that was in 1925, so 10 years after his execution. And you know, in the song it goes, you're 10 years dead, I never died, says he. And then, so that was in 25, and then it was set to music in 1936. It's been around a while now.
Thanks for that.
Okay, well, thanks for the question. Others are welcome. Again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So there was no, in this case, there was no physical evidence at all.
Zero physical evidence. There was never a murder weapon recovered. There were, you know, no fingerprints or anything like that. And I said there was no blood in the store. There was really no positive identification, or certainly no conclusive identification. There were some neighbors who thought they saw somebody who resembled Hill, but they couldn't actually say with certainty that it was Hill, and nor could the surviving witness, the 13-year-old son of John Morrison, who was cowering in the back of the store. He got enough of a look at them to say that they were wearing masks, these two men who rushed into the store, but that was about it, so he couldn't possibly positively identify Hill either.
So what did the prosecution offer as a motive?
They offered no motive. They dodged that question entirely. All they could say, they turned the case, ironically, you know, this was not initially a case about labor or about, you know, labor versus capitalism or class conflict or anything like that. This was a straight murder case. But the prosecutor had no motive, and they turned it into putting the IWW on trial against civil society, basically. So he painted Joe Hill as this, you know, brutal monster who represented everything bad about, you know, working class people, and turned him into this, really, I mean, dehumanized him, demonized him. And that was basically it. Joe Hill carried a red card, a membership card in the Industrial Workers of the World, and that essentially was enough to convict
him. Yeah. Well, I should give you the opportunity maybe to talk a little bit more about the Wobblies, about the IWW, about what this organization was and about why it was that that some people in America at the time would have considered it to be such a dangerous organization.
Yeah, they were founded in 1905 in Chicago, actually. And Big Bill Haywood, who was the chairman of the founding convention, called it the Continental Congress of the Working Class. And it differed from the other union, the big labor federation, the American Federation of Labor, because it encouraged membership by those on the margins of society, women, minorities, people of nationalities that weren't necessarily welcomed by the traditional industrial unions at the time. And so they were kind of a collection of misfits in some ways, and they really were committed to organizing those who were down in the gutter, as Haywood liked to say. And their tactics were substantially different from the AFL. They didn't believe in collective bargaining. They didn't believe in reforming capitalism, or that capitalism could be reformed, for that matter. They espoused revolutionary rhetoric, and they really adhered to a kind of Marxian economics. Although Haywood himself liked to say that he had never read Marx's Capital, but I have the marks of Capital all over me. So they were, they were the kind of people that inspired both, you know, fear and idolatry, I think, this union. And the press fanned those flames of fear everywhere they went. They were tainted as violent bomb thrower types, and in fact, any violence they were involved in was committed against them.
So, as far as Joe Hill went, as an individual. Initially, as we explained, the authorities liked him for the murder because he had the gunshot wound. And then apparently they liked him even better when they found out that he was a card-carrying member of the IWW. Was it just anything else specific about him that the prosecution, you would argue that the prosecution was motivated by a desire to strike a blow against the IWW, and that by convicting Joe Hill, they were doing that. So in a sense, it really wasn't about Joe Hill.
Well, it wasn't about Hill, except for he was their primary songwriter. Mm-hmm. And again, music at the time was just, it's hard to imagine now, but it was such an important way of organizing people. And his songs were really, you know, quite threatening, I think, in their rhetoric and in the way they brought people together. And they started every street meeting the IWW did, and that's generally where they met, in the streets, with songs, and most often they were singing his songs. So once they found out that he was the songwriter, I think it did make a difference that he wasn't just another Wobbly.
In this hour of Focus, we're talking with William Adler. He's written for a number of publications, including Esquire, Rolling Stone, Mother Jones, and he is the author of a new book that's titled The Man Who Never Died. It's about Joe Hill, an American labor icon. Bloomsbury is the publisher. Well, a lot of the book here is about this specific event. It's about the crime. It's about the trial. It's about how people around the world thought about it. But there also is a section in the book that's a biography of Joe Hill. I mean, it talks about his life prior to these events. Just tell us a little bit more about Joe Hill.
Sure. As I mentioned, he was born in Sweden in 1879. He came from a musical family, and Sweden at the time was a theocracy. The state church basically controlled every aspect of one's life, which may not have been so good for Joe Hill, but it was great for a biographer, because basically all his records were extant. I mean, there was his report cards, his church records, his hospital records, and, you know, all sorts of other personal documents that were most helpful to me in constructing his life. And it was especially helpful because once he immigrated to the United States in 1902, for about the next, 6 or 8 years prior to his joining the Industrial Workers of the World out west, he didn't leave much of a record. He was an itinerant worker, and, you know, he wasn't blogging about his trips. So it was at that point, it was a little blurry what he was doing. I mean, we have bits and pieces. We know that he wrote a Christmas card home from Cleveland in 1905 and that he was caught in the earthquake in San Francisco in April of the following year. And he wrote about that for his hometown paper in Gävle, Sweden. And that struck me as really interesting because right then you knew this wasn't your average hobo. This guy wrote a pretty lengthy article in a detailed description of what he saw and found and felt during that earthquake. And then he ended up going up to the northwest to Portland to work in the port there, and that's where he joined the IWW in 1908.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the trial. We come to the trial. And here there were witnesses who claimed to have seen the men and said that, well, even though that they were masked, that they thought that it could, in fact, have been Joe Hill. And, you know, one could argue that if you had a really good lawyer, you ought to be able at least to attack that. But one of the problems was here, it was the attitude, perhaps, that Joe Hill brought with him to the trial.
Absolutely. He was kind of a cocky and arrogant guy, and that became apparent to me as I read his correspondence from the 22 months that he spent in prison. But he also had this kind of interesting combination of that and naivety. And he thought that eventually the American system of jurisprudence that he had learned about in Sweden would work to clear his name if he was truly innocent, and that he would be given a presumption of innocence. But during the trial, about the second day of the trial, it became clear to him that these court-appointed lawyers, the pair of them that he had, were not rigorously questioning the state's witnesses, and he stood up in the middle of court and announced that he was firing his lawyers, that he was tired of having three lawyers working against him, the prosecutor and his own two lawyers, which caused quite a hubbub, as you can imagine, in the courtroom, and which I think really poisoned the jury against Hill right there, if they weren't already poisoned against him.
Well, would it be likely that just simply based on his background as a labor activist, that would have been enough to poison the jury?
Well, it certainly helped. But I think, you know, they saw that he had this attitude about him, as you said, and he had contempt, I think, at that point for the judicial system. And you know, these jurors were officers of the court. And they were part of the process, and they felt that they were being disrespected as well, I believe.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, as we explained earlier, the big thing that the state had here was the fact that Joe Hill had been shot. He had this gunshot wound. And again, going back to the story, was there was this suspicion that possibly that the son of the man who was killed, who was also killed, had managed to get off a shot and had hit one of the assailants. So here we have a man who's got a gunshot wound. And the thing was, and the place at which Joe Hill could have assisted in his defense was to say what happened. Well, he wouldn't. He wouldn't say.
No, he really offered a minimalist defense. He refused to testify about the circumstances of his wound, and he basically said, why should I have to prove my innocence? They've got to prove my guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And he stuck to that principle right up until the end.
Mm-hmm.
He maintained his silence through the trial, through the appeal, through hearings before the State Board of Pardons, and right up until the end. And this was despite pleadings from not only from the state and, you know, personal appeals from the governor and and other state officials, but from his friends, from his supporters and his close allies and the industrial workers of the world. They were also saying to him, you know, you're worth a lot more to the movement alive than you are dead. But he disagreed.
Yeah. Here, the one sort of tantalizing clue was that, and if I remember this right again, he goes to the doctor. That the doctor says, "Well, who shot you?" And the Joe Hill said something. Well, it was this guy, and you know, we were having a disagreement over a woman, and that's all he would say. Well, you actually managed to turn up a piece of evidence that corroborates that story.
I did. In the course of my archival research, I ran across some correspondence from an academic who was at work on a novel about Hill and the industrial workers of the world in the late 1940s. And he never published the novel. And, I think actually his daughter later told me that he got swept up in the HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee dragnet, and I think was one reason that he never did publish it. In any event, I found him because I'd seen some correspondence from this academic to some archivists, various archives, actually. He had done a lot of in-depth research, especially for a novelist. I was really surprised. And I wanted to see if I could find his notes, his research, since I couldn't find evidence of his book. And so I located his survivors, and his daughter, herself an academic, as it happens, found his research materials in her attic in Michigan. And among those notes, which she gave me, was an exchange of letters between her father and one Hilda Erickson. And they were written in the summer of 1949. Well, Hilda Erickson was indeed the woman over whom Joe Hill was shot. And she also names the fellow who shot Joe Hill in this letter, who had once been engaged to Hilda, and it turns out, says Hilda, that she had broken off the engagement about a week before Joe Hill was shot, and the fiancé did not react well to that, and he and Joe Hill had it out one night, and that night happened to be January 10th, 1914, the same night that the Morrisons were murdered.
So she does, in this fact, in this letter, say she sees Joe after the event. Joe is obviously hurt, and she says, "What happened?" And he says, "Well, this other man, this man who had been her former fiancé, had shot him."
Correct.
So when you ask this question, well, why is it that Joe Hill at trial didn't explain the circumstances of the shooting? It's complicated because part of it has to do with his feelings about who he was and what he represented. But at least in part, apparently, he was just interested in protecting Hilda Erickson and didn't want her dragged into the whole thing. So part of it you'd have to put up to chivalry.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was kind of this Victorian chivalry. And also, he wanted to protect her, I think, because in his own background in Sweden, his family had been exposed to all sorts of ridicule because his mother had been what the Church of Sweden called a whore's child, and that was in the official church records. His grandmother was unmarried when his mother was born, and that was a stigma, like a red letter attached to her, and I think he carried that with him for the rest of his life.
We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is William Adler. We're talking about his book about Joe Hill. The title is The Man Who Never Died. And I'm sure that people will, probably a lot of people will recognize that title comes from the famous song. I think a lot of people will know the version that Joan Baez sings in the film Woodstock. A very memorable performance. Someone, by the way, just called in, called in, I think, and they said they were interested in knowing where you could find the lyrics for that song. It's in your book, I'm sure, but is it easy just to find the words to the song?
Oh, sure. If you Google the words, they'll I'm sure. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night. They'll come right up, yes.
Okay. Another caller here to talk with in Effingham. Let's do that. Line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, it just occurred to me that if your guest might see or find any similarities in social connections between the Haymarket Martyrs and Joe Hill. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, certainly. I mean, I think there is a connection. It's not really a direct connection, but there is a connection between the Haymarket Martyrs and the IWW, because some of those survivors, like Lucy Parsons, for instance, from Haymarket, was one of the founders of the Industrial Workers of the World. So there is that connection. And, of course, Haymarket Martyrs are buried in Chicago. Joe Hill was funeralized in Chicago, although his ashes were spread all over the country. In fact, they were spread in every state but Utah per his request.
Hmm. That's another really a remarkable story here. This is sort of jumping to the end, but yeah. He was found guilty. He was executed. He was cremated. His ashes were put into envelopes and kind of passed around, and the idea was that they would be spread various places around the world. And I think that I read somewhere that some of these packets of his ashes were still floating around as late as the 80s?
Well, that's right. There was a packet seized by the United States Postal Service, which was basically, or the Postal Bureau, I think it was called, back in 1917, when the federal government raided every IWW office. This is in the time just after America entered World War I, and the IWW was strongly anti-war, and so that was another reason they needed to be eradicated in the government's viewpoint. Anyway, they seized a packet of Joe Hill's ashes, and until the 1980s, they were reposing in a file cabinet in the National Archives. And some archivists found them. I think there were a few other oddities found, penguin bones and just all sorts of weird stuff that they wrote them. And they wrote it up in the National Archives newsletter. And it said, well, we found a pack of Joe Hill's ashes. And that news made its way back to the IWW, which still exists. It was kind of down and out for a long time, and it's back, much diminished, but it is back now. And the National Archives turned over those ashes to the IWW, and in turn, those last ashes were spread in 1989 over a grave, actually, in Colorado, where there had been a massacre of IWW members in 1927 and 28.
All right, let's talk with somebody else here. Terre Haute, line 4. Hello.
Hello. You might talk a little bit about the connection between Eugene Debs and Joe Hill, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Debs was of course one of the high profile supporters of Joe Hill during the 22 months he was imprisoned, and Debs wrote a couple of passionate letters to the governor of Utah, exhorting him to give Joe Hill a new trial. And so he did what he could. He wrote about him in Appeal to Reason, the newspaper Debs wrote for. And trying to think if there was anything else. I can't think of any other direct connection. I've never found any correspondence between Hill and Debs, although I did between Debs and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who was a Wobbly and one of Joe Hill's most active and important supporters.
Yeah. So here we're coming down to about 5 minutes. We certainly should talk about the national and international reaction to the event, because it was a cause célèbre around the world, but people who felt that this was a political trial. It was a political prosecution as much as it was anything else. And no less than the President of the United States even weighed in on this.
That's true. President Woodrow Wilson twice intervened in Joe Hill's behalf. I should back up a moment to say that there was a tremendous pressure campaign organized by the IWW on the governor of Utah. And that resulted in some 40,000 letters, telegrams, and petitions flooding the governor's office, calling on him to either pardon Joe Hill or commute his sentence from death to life, or, as Joe Hill insisted upon, granting him a new trial. And eventually, that pressure did reach the White House, and through some high-level contacts that Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, in fact, had with Democratic circles in New York, they reached into the White House, and she went down and personally appealed to Wilson. And Wilson said, "Well, you know, I don't know if I can help him. Might only hurt." And Elizabeth Gurley Flynn said to him, "Well, you know, he's going to die tomorrow. There's not much more you can do that's going to hurt him." And indeed, he wrote a telegram, Wilson did, on the eve of Joe Hill's first execution date, and that resulted in a 30-day reprieve. It wasn't enough, of course, for Joe Hill, but it did save his life for a while.
Yeah, and when it came down to the execution, I like this story, too. At least the story is that the authorities said, well, you're going to be put to death. You can have your choice. You can be hung. You can be shot. And Joe said, well, I've been shot at before, so I'll take that.
That's right. That was a humane gesture on the part of Utah to give them the choice of hanging or shooting.
Well, this, again, sort of brings us back around first full circle kind of to the point where we started at the beginning, which was your interest in finding out about this character, who he was, why it is that he's become a folk hero of American labor, but more important, what motivated him, because as now people will understand that he might still have been convicted, but at the very least, he could have made a defense. He could have explained how it was he was shot. He could have said, you know, I don't know John Morrison. I'd never know John Morrison. I would have no reason to shoot John Morrison. And that he didn't. And that perhaps he actually became so caught up in this being about something bigger than him, that he decided that he wouldn't mount a defense, and he would go down for the cause.
Yeah, I really do think that he believed he could serve the Union and serve the cause of liberation, the cause of liberation of working people, as he would have put it, much better dead than alive. He felt like his death could mean something. And he saw it as a means to an end, the liberation of the working class, not necessarily as an end.
And people did try to persuade him otherwise, to try to persuade him to do something to live. And of course, then that leads us to what is one of the most famous quotes attributed to him.
Yeah, on the eve of his execution, he sent a telegram to Bill Haywood, his friend and the general secretary of the Union in Chicago. And he said, don't mourn, organize. And that really became a watchword and slogan of all of organized labor.
Yeah, and certainly that comes up in the famous song that we talked about. But it's also sort of remarkable just how what an important figure he is, and how many songs and poems and stories and how often he has been mentioned, even up to the present.
Yeah, I think his name has been invoked a lot recently. I mean, just, you know, in the last year, with the renewed emphasis on labor and what's going on in Wisconsin and Ohio and Indiana and elsewhere, in terms of trying to curtail employees' rights, public employees' rights to organize, you hear a lot if Joe Hill were on the picket line today, he'd be writing songs, and I'm sure he would be. He'd have plenty of material.
Yeah, this I think maybe people don't always appreciate how writing a book like this, how much work this is, and you know, this takes a lot of research, and it takes many years of work to produce this. So as a writer, I'm sure you have to be pretty driven to accomplish such a thing. And here in your case, you also had discovered this wonderful thing, and you're able to really bring something new to this story, some new facets of the story that we wouldn't have had before. What got you interested in Joe Hill in the first place?
Well, it had a lot to do with, as I mentioned earlier, Bob Dylan talking about him. But I also think, as I began reading the earlier biographies of Hill, and as you suggested, they weren't they didn't go into very much depth about his life. Mm-hmm. It did occur to me that there was a lot of relevance. His story had a lot of relevance to today, and I began thinking about the parallels. And it just struck me that his was a great and largely untold story. I mean, there was this myth of Joe Hill, but what if you tried to peel back somebody's myth and just got at the man? And I thought that could be a really fascinating study of really a folk heroism in America, for one thing, because what does it take to be a folk hero? And it seemed to me that, you know, Joe Hill earned his mythology the hard way. And I wanted to explore that a little bit.
Yeah, well, and the book certainly does that. Now, I hope now people won't say, well, I've got the story. No, there's really, it's a good read, and there's more in rich detail about the man and his life that we have not discussed here on the program. So it's a good way to observe Labor Day by at least taking a look at the book that we're talking about, The Man Who Never Died, Lifetimes and Legacy of Joe Hill, American Labor Icon. Bloomsbury is the publisher, by our guest, William Adler. And Mr. Adler, thanks very much for talking with us.
David, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
And you have been listening to a program from the Focus Archives, a show we first broadcast on August 31st, so that was indeed right before Labor Day. We have a lot of past programs available as archives on our website. That way you can listen to shows you might have missed. You also can check up on the schedule for what we'll be doing in the future. That's all at WILL.illinois.edu. I have a moment here to tell you about tomorrow. In the first part of the program, journalist Siddhartha Deb talks with us about his book, The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of the New India. This was a show, in fact, we had scheduled for, I think, about 2 weeks ago and didn't happen at the time, but we got him back with us. And it's a book that looks at life in contemporary India, particularly the effect on India, society, culture of the rapid modernization that's going on. And what the author does is he picks five people that he believes represents in some way different classes, different regions, and uses them to tell the story of globalization and what it's meant for the place where he, that is the author, Siddhartha Deb, was born. That'll be hour number one. And then in the second hour, we will look back to Jonestown. And people will recall what happened there with the mass suicide of Jim Jones and his followers in the fall of 1978. We will be talking with Julia Shear. She has authored a book that's titled A Thousand Lives. And what she did was take advantage of a lot of material that had been collected by the FBI, some of it recently declassified, to try to paint a picture of who the people were that followed Jim Jones, concentrating particularly on a few of them. And there were people who, she argues, followed Jones because they believed that he could lead them to a better life. And when they went there to the jungles of Guyana, they also believed that they could leave at any time. We'll talk about what it is that motivated them and get a better picture of who these people were as we talk with Julia Shears about her book, A Thousand Lives, tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics for you each week. And again, check the schedule by going to our website, WILL.illinois.edu.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Seaboat in Champaign, with a Southern-style menu that features catfish, chicken, shrimp, sandwiches, dinners, and more, available for carryout, delivery, and catering. The Seaboat, on West Kirby, across from County Market. Delivery and catering services available at 351-6200. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Compañía Flamenco José Porcel in a sensational evening of dance on Thursday, November 17th. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
Well, that's it for us on Focus for this morning, but we want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. Prices are lower today. In Kansas City, December wheat, $6.91, down 14. March, $7.01.5, down 13.75. December wheat in Chicago is trading at $6.16. That's down 16.75. The March contract, $6.36, down 11.75. December corn, $6.38.75, down 6.75. March, $6.48.25, down 6.5. May, $6.54, down 6.5. July, $6.56, down 7. January soybeans, $11.84.25, down 16. March, $11.94.5, down 15.75. May, $12.03.75, down 16. July, $12.13.5, down 14.75. December soybean meal, $2.96.60, down $4.80. December oil, 52.10, down 50. December live cattle, 121.40, down 32.5. February, 123.80, down 25. November feeder cattle, 143.37.5, down 12.5. The January contract up 47.5 at 148.85. And December lean hogs, 85.92.5, down 52.5. Outside markets, December crude oil, 101.64, up 2.27. The U.S. dollar, 78.03, up 16. The CRB index, 320.90, up 3. The Dow is off 45. The S&P 500 is off 5, and the NASDAQ is off 13. The Dow currently stands at 12,049. It's noon Central Time, 41 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. The forecast for East Central